I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is The Two Matts for the week ending Friday, the 20th of October. A podcast that has not given up on hope, despite it all. What did we talk about this episode, Matt?
Well, obviously we had to talk about the ongoing crisis in the Middle East, which you know, is occupying all the oxygen, really, in the media room at the moment. And we had a good discussion about all the shuttle diplomacy that's been going on.
I've listened to a lot of podcasts on this topic lately, and I think that ours is slightly broader in terms about what the European Union yes. is doing, what Germany is doing, and we had our special guest, Tanit Koch, all the way from Frankfurt.
Which is very underreported in the UK, yeah. what's going on in the EU. And it's important to what's going to happen in the Middle East, actually.
And
it
I really think is. Tanit's insight, which you'll get, folks, in the second half of the podcast, is fascinating, especially if you care about the bigger picture and not just the sort of day-to-day row that we see in the yes. media in the UK. Okay, so what are we going to call the episode?
Well, we gave Biden some, you know, serious praise for his performance.
Which, coming from you, was...
I've been a big
Biden fan.
Well, I've been the first to say, you know, I'm the first to say that I'm happy to eat my hat over this.
Yeah.
You know, I'll take that.
Okay. So, what real statesmanship looks like?
What real statesmanship looks like.
Okay, let's go with that. Okay, so this is The Two Matts, episode 18, What Real Statesmanship Looks Like. Enjoy.
Enjoy.
So, Matt, what are we talking about this week, as if there's anything else to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there is only one subject to talk about, and it's a bleak one. I mean, I feel now we're recording this on Thursday. This is day 13, and it's day 13 of a crisis that I fear is going to go on for quite a long time. There's no question there are terrible times ahead.
Yeah.
It's interesting because today, Thursday, Rishi Sunak has been in Tel Aviv, and he did an appearance of sorts with Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister. And I don't know what you think, but I'll
tell you what I think in a minute.
Yeah, but I was going to say is that, you know, to put it politely, it compared to some of the other people that have been through it, we can go on to talk about, it looked pretty inconsequential.
Weaselly, I sort of thought.
It was like diplomatic tourism, you know?
Yeah, it was odd. I mean, as ever, and I don't want to get hung up on this because maybe it's just a language tick, but I would commend people to listen to how often he refers to himself, you know, in the first person. And he said, you know, I just thought it was important to be here to show Israel that the United Kingdom and I stand fully beside you.
Yes.
You know, it's like, and I, what the hell, and I? I mean, yes, you represent the United Kingdom, mate. It's Rishi Sunak as a person is of no greater relevance than the United Kingdom. You're there to represent the UK. You and I, what I'm doing, you know, it's all about him. You know, it seems so weird.
I also felt that, you know, when you think of, even in recent history, Tony Blair or Gordon Brown or even David Cameron going to theatres where there were serious conflict, it really mattered. And there is this sense, there's no question about it, and I know it's the thing that we talk about most, but there's a reason for it, is that post-Brexit United Kingdom is just less of a power than it was.
Yeah.
And that was very visibly apparent. You could see the Netanyahu was going through the motions, being polite,
Well, he'd done the big one, hadn't he?
Which is what we should, I think, focus on in this.
And I think if we compare, just before we leave the subject of Rishi Sunak, I was struck because Matt Fry from Channel 4 News pinned him down, as he so often excellently does, and asked him essentially, you know, will you be urging restraint on Israel? And Sunak wouldn't answer the question. Just said, first of all, what I'd like to say is it's how important it is that I am here, you know, blah, 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 blah. And completely ignored the sentiment of the question, which is, are you actually going to do anything statesmanlike and say, Benjamin, please, you know, let's think this through before you raise Gaza to the ground. Richard Bacon tweeted, I've been really surprised by how much I've come to dislike Rishi Sunak. He's just a bland, cautious, wet nothing with no ideas. He can't even come up with a phrase that allows him to express a bit of concern for innocent kids in Gaza. And he's absolutely right.
Well, it looked like Netanyahu was having a slightly incomprehensible public meeting with his accountant.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't make sense of it. On the other hand, and in big contrast, and, you know, I've been pretty critical of Joe Biden.
Yes, the one before last we discussed, you know, was he out of his depth?
Was he out of his depth? And I'm happy to eat my words to this extent that I think whatever else happens now between this week and the presidential election in November 2024, what Joe Biden did in Tel Aviv on Wednesday was historic.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it was actually, people have quite grasped how historic it was. I think it will be remembered, I hope it will, on a par with Kennedy in 63 saying, Ich bin ein Berliner in West Berlin, or Reagan saying, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall in 87. Now, he doesn't have the sort of, Biden doesn't have the kind of megawattage charisma of either of those two presidents. But if you go through what Biden did, it was unbelievably smart and helpful. So, number one, he asserts American hard power. He puts two carrier groups into the region, the Eisenhower and the Ford. And this is a message especially to Iran and Hezbollah, saying just don't even think
about
it.
When you say carrier groups, you're talking about big
aircraft carrier groups.
And all the associated ships.
And all the associated ships.
Like an armada, isn't it?
It's like an armada. And they're sitting there and there's a message to Iran and Hezbollah before anything else, saying, don't even think about it, guys. And we've heard him say, don't. And he obviously shows he means it. Before he left, he goes on 60 Minutes and he agrees that Hamas has to be eliminated entirely, which is a big deal because that's the basic starting point of the Israeli strategy. So he arrives with that already offered to Netanyahu. The fact that he goes there is a big deal. No American president has ever been to Israel in the middle of a war.
Yeah.
No American president went before Nixon in 1974.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So, you know, and this is an 80-year-old man.
Yeah.
So while Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, is in Beijing with, excuse me, Vladimir Putin and Xi lecturing Israel at the Belt and Road Conference, Biden is in Israel taking a big, big risk. He takes an even bigger one. He says he believes the Israeli account of what happened with the awful attack on Tuesday night with the hospital. He said, you know, it was done by the other team. Now, clearly he has intelligence suggesting that, but that was a risk.
And it was an unfortunate choice of words, wasn't it? Because the other team thing got over. That became the story. This isn't a game. But anyway, moving on from that, that was a big deal to
that
state
was a
that.
Very big deal. And you could see Netanyahu registering as such.
Yeah.
Then he does what he does so well, which is show empathy. And I think if we could ask our producer, the third Matt, to give us
Can
a clip.
Can you play that clip?
To those who are grieving, a child, a parent, a spouse, a sibling, a friend, I know you feel like there's that black hole in the middle of your chest. You feel like you're being sucked into it. The survivor's remorse, the anger, the questions of faith in your soul. Starting at staring at that empty chair, sitting Shiva. The first Sabbath without them. They're the everyday things, the small things that you miss the most. The scent when you open the closet door. The morning coffee you shared together. the bend of his smile, the perfect pitch of her laugh, the giggle of her little boy, the baby. For those who have lost loved ones, this is what I know. They'll never be truly gone.
I mean, that's a really big thing. Yeah. Because obviously anyone who knows Biden's history knows he lost his son, Beau Biden, yeah. in 2015, and earlier in a horrific car crash in the 70s, lost a wife and a young daughter.
Yeah. So he knows about
he
loss
knows that,
on a personal
and
basis,
he speaks
yeah.
with authenticity and power. Yeah. And but he's crucially, he's doing it in Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
So that then enables him to, you know, he's bought himself permission
yeah.
to do some quite big things. And he says in that speech, same speech, you know, don't do what America did after 9/11.
Yeah.
You know, I caution this, while you feel that rage, don't be consumed by it. After 9/11, we were enraged in the United States. While we sought justice and got justice, we also made mistakes. Again, a big thing.
Huge, huge thing to say. And
very
and just
consequential.
From a rhetorical point of view, when you look at great speeches, they are the simple sentences that
yes.
that hang around for eternity.
That's it.
And that sentence is, although you feel the rage, don't be consumed by it. That is one of those sentences. This will be known as the don't be consumed by rage
speech. It's a keeper. You know? But because he's there, and because of all the things we've already mentioned,
yeah.
the Israelis, you could see, didn't feel hectored
yes.
or told off.
Yeah.
They felt, right, this guy gets it. He's empathizing. But he's making a point about not giving into rage. Now, I don't know whether Netanyahu and you know, the Israeli Defense Force will listen. It's very early to say. I hope they will.
Isn't it in a small sense? They've already listened to a degree in
yes.
the sense that they you know, we were all expecting, for last time we did this podcast on the Thursday last week, we thought by the weekend that Gaza would be in
this
absolute
diplomacy round
yeah.
is having a very constructive effect, because it's delayed that moment.
Yeah, because they can't do it while
they're there. So that, all of that.
Yeah.
Then also there's a practical thing, which is there was a logjam emerging over the whole question of humanitarian aid, and specifically the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt. And Biden broke it in private and got the Egyptians and, you know, the Israelis at least.
Yeah.
We'll see what Hamas do. To get the trucks starting to roll. And I say starting to roll because, you know, as I wrote in the New European this week, we need the Rafah crossing open throughout this conflict.
Yeah.
As a bare minimum.
Yeah.
And I don't know with any confidence that it will be, but at least the prospect that it will be intermittently open is now achieved. And that's a big win. He was only there for about 7 hours.
No, and so that you sent me a WhatsApp and you said, this is pure statesmanship. And that's exactly what it was. You know, it was a statesman at work.
And the weird thing and the sad thing is that we've forgotten that.
Yeah. It's almost, I'm sorry to say, but since Blair, actually, Even you might have a different view. I'm not even sure Cameron.
No, I don't. I think since Blair
enough.
Is the right.
Since Blair, Britain just hasn't had the chutzpah, the power to make that kind of difference.
And look at Trump.
Yeah.
Trump has been. I mean, the Republicans, first of all, can't even elect a speaker. So there's money meant to be going through Congress at the moment for this, which is being snarled up by their incompetence.
Yeah.
And Trump has, even by his own standards, disgraced himself by having a go at Netanyahu. Netanyahu rang Biden to congratulate him about the 2020 election. So Trump has a beef with him.
Right.
That's the level on which that man works, you know, and he said that Hezbollah are very smart.
Yeah.
And suddenly you realize that, you know, Biden is too old to be president. There's no question. But by God, he was presidential this week.
Yeah, he was, yeah.
And I just hope that it, you know, that the good things that he's managed to achieve this week, the credit in the bank continues. And I hope that, you know, I don't know how often Biden will be able to go back to Israel, but I hope that when Anthony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, or Lloyd Austin, the US Defense Secretary, goes back, or indeed other Western diplomats, that it continues to globalize the thing.
Yeah,
because what the disaster in all of this is, Israel feeling isolated.
Yeah.
You know, this was good, this. Or as good as it's going to get, anyway. Yeah. And the more of it we can have, the more sense of, we'll help you, but think before you do the following.
Yeah, no, that sentiment. I mean, I was reminded of, you know, it was very paternalistic in a way, wasn't it? It was like a father talking to a grieving son, almost, you know, saying, you know, I've been there and I understand what's happening, but please try and just take a step back for a moment, you know. But equally, as you say, you can only make that kind of speech if you can do something beyond that to help in hard terms. If you can send carrier groups, you know, where's our bloody aircraft carrier, by the way, these days? Is it at sea anymore?
No, I mean, we have sent some Royal Navy and Marine presence, but I mean...
But I mean, we are so diminished as a kind of
It's a sideshow, either way.
I mean, it has been for decades, if the truth's told.
Again, we always on this podcast like to step back, and I think that, you know, this is a huge difference between the Biden of August 2021 retreating from Afghanistan.
Yeah.
There's a kind of sad recognition in underpinning all this that actually America is not in a position yet to withdraw from the world. No one, I think, wants it to be the global policeman, but equally, no one wants it to retreat behind the MAGA Trump stockade either. No. And he's giving a speech. We're recording this before it to the nation from the Oval Office on Thursday evening about, you know, big plans for the Middle East and for Ukraine. So there's this bizarre sense that actually after the long period of Obama trying to withdraw from the forever wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and then Trump saying America first, with a sort of MAGA version of that, and Biden saying, yep, we're leaving Afghanistan for keeps, over to the Taliban, we've done our best, that somehow, you know, we're getting back in by stages to the necessary supranationalism of the modern world.
Yeah,
you know, it can't be any other way.
Talking of supranationalism, Egypt is going to play a big role in this.
So important.
I mean, Egypt controlled Gaza up until 19, whenever it was, when the Israelis effectively kicked them out.
67.
Have you seen the Mohamed Salah video?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we talk about statesmanship. Okay, here's an extraordinary piece of statesmanship from another, you know, from exactly the opposite end of.
Yeah.
And I actually wonder whether, in terms of influence and relevance, you know, Mo Salah's probably packing more punch with a lot of Egyptians and Palestinians and people in the Arab world than any politician. And if people haven't seen it, I think it's been viewed about 200 million times now in 12 hours. I
mean, it's phenomenal.
And I've never seen anything like it from a sports person, really. And it's a very darkly framed video with Mo Salah saying, there's just been too much pain, you know, can we all basically calm down, please, and just take a step back. And I think, you know, it's very consequential, and it probably is, you know, an example of somebody saying something human, which seems utterly absent with a lot of the commentators, especially, I don't know what it's like in the States, but especially here, the argument seems to have devolved completely into, you know, whether you're dogmatically pro-Palestinian or dogmatically pro-Israeli, and what's in the middle, i.e. the common shared humanity of it, seems to be getting lost in the debate. There are some people who should know better, who are just shit-stirring.
Well, I noticed Jeremy Corbyn, certainly at the time of recording, Jeremy Corbyn's tweet saying, or X or post or whatever you want to call it now, saying it was definitely Israel that bombed the hospital.
Yeah.
Has 11 million views and is still up.
Yeah, a disgrace.
I mean, it is a disgrace. And it's also, you know, you have to go back to October the 7th. What happened on October the 7th was, certainly in modern times, you know, an unprecedented pogrom. No nation on earth would not take action in response to it.
Yeah, of course.
The question is what action? Yeah. And the more that Israel feels the warm hug of candid friends from other countries, the better, the less suffering there will be, the more chance there is of I would go no further than the very beginnings of dialogue. Mm. You know, this is going to be a long haul. Countries and areas and regions don't come back from this kind of trauma. You know, the number of people I've seen on Newsnight and other programs talking airily about a two-state solution. Well, do you think? I mean, yeah, great. But, you know, to say that that's on the table at the moment is like saying that in 1941, a wonderfully social democratic Germany was just around the corner.
Yeah.
No, it's silliness. It's not talking topically. And I think that that what has happened this week and why Biden's intervention was so important was that it enabled, or it should enable, people to get a measure of what lies ahead, brace themselves for it, but not give up all hope that there are ways of keeping this from turning into, you know, even more of a bloodbath than it already is. It is already a bloodbath, and indeed escalating beyond Gaza and the sort of immediate precincts in Israel, which is a clear and present danger.
I think the response has to be absolutely surgical. They do have to eradicate Hamas. There's no question about that. But you can't do that by absolutely destroying an entire
nation. No, and it's very difficult, you know, because it is, as we know, one of the most densely populated areas in the whole world.
Yeah.
We also know that Hamas practices what... there's a great book called The Utility of Force by General Sir Rupert Smith that came out in 2005, I think. And it's he argues in that the wars of the future will be wars amongst the people, he calls them.
Right.
And what his point is that forces like Hamas don't come out onto the battlefield, or if they do, it's only for a brief incursion like the one that happened on October the 7th. They hide themselves amongst civilians. They live in tunnels. They don't go around in tanks. They use what are called technicals, civilian vehicles that are modified for.
So they're not wearing badges.
They're not wearing badges.
Amber-gaiter shoes.
And also they are very adept, because there's about 10,000 full time Hamas fighters, Western intelligence thinks, but they can mobilize 40,000 to 50,000 people very quickly.
Yeah.
And after the bombardment of the last few days, that number is probably going to get bigger. And
there was a good piece in The Spectator, actually, about on the day where the thesis being that when the actual Hamas operatives launched the pogrom, lots and lots of other disaffected Palestinian kids effectively thought, right, let's go, you know, and joined in. So it became magnified in that sense. So there's it's not black and white. There's a fringe. There's a hinterland of people who, you know, are angry and hate the Israelis, but they're not Hamas as well. So you've got to have a kind of plan for what after Hamas. You know, how do you, if you just eradicate Hamas and then say, okay, right, on you go, the conditions have to change as well, you know, or a new Hamas will just spring up.
Yes,
you know?
I mean, this is why I'm so unimpressed by Guterres and the UN, because what we need now from the UN is planning for some sort of coalition of the willing-led transitional authority.
Like Bosnia.
In Gaza, like Bosnia.
Yeah.
You know, and we're not there yet, and it won't be there for a while. But I don't think the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, is up to it. Indeed, the West Bank is on the verge of just becoming totally disorderly. There are lots of young Palestinians who are furious with Mahmoud Abbas and the PA for not being radical enough.
Yeah.
So the idea that was broached a little bit in the first days of, oh, well, the Palestinian Authority could just take over, I don't think so. And I think that, in fact, though this is so counter to orthodoxy nowadays, because it has the whiff of nation building, which I'm not advocating, but I do think there will have to be some sort of interim authority in Gaza, simply to, you know, get the infrastructure working again.
Although
to get
the Israelis probably wouldn't, in their current setup, wouldn't tolerate that.
Well, that's why, and now again we're at the bone, which is, that's why it's so important that Biden and the real players are going out now to get themselves some credit in the bank, because the end game of this, when it finally arises, the sooner the better, one hopes, will be very difficult. And you're right, you know, the last thing they'll want is a sort of, the Israelis, is a kind of Paddy Ashdown figure.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. But it, I think it will need something like that.
But I think
that.
That's what it does need.
Yes. Yeah,
it really does. Okay, well, listen, thank you, folks. Hope you enjoyed that conversation so far. We've got a fantastic guest coming up after the break, and we'll be talking about Germany's position in all of this and how the EU are looking at Israel. And we're talking to a woman who knows exactly the inside track on
she
that.
She certainly
so
does.
Stay tuned. So this week, I have a very special offer for you. If you choose to subscribe to The New European and get much more of what you hear on this podcast in print or online, we have free signed copies of James O'Brien's brilliant new hardback book, How They Broke Britain. And I've read it. Have you read it, Matt?
No, I'm looking forward to it.
I'm going to send you the PDF.
Please.
An advance from the publisher. It's absolutely brilliant. You'd expect nothing less from
he's great.
James O'Brien.
He's fantastic.
But it is absolutely devastating and insightful. And you read it and you are entertained and absolutely livid in equal measure.
He's one of a kind. He really is.
So James O'Brien is signing hundreds and hundreds of copies of new books, waiting for lovely new subscribers to The New European. And you can get all we do online for just £1 a week. Or if, like me and like the other Matt, you prefer to get your newspaper delivered to your door every week, you can have that for just another pound a week. The heft of the newspaper dropping on your doormat. Think of the joy it brings every single week. And you'll be doing something positive about the state of the media in this country, though I say so myself. So anyway, go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2Matts. That's the number 2. M-A-T-T-S, theneweuropean.co.uk/2Matts, and subscribe to The New European from just £1 a week and get a free copy of James O'Brien's brilliant new book signed by the author himself.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah. That plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Welcome back. I'm delighted to say we're joined now by Tanit Koch, who is a New European columnist. She writes the fabulously entertaining German-splaining column every week, which gives great insight into how Germany works, and it is really, really very, very good. And Tanit is also a former editor of Bild, which is it's the biggest newspaper in Europe, actually. And so, Tanit, you're joining us from Frankfurt, from the Frankfurt Book Fair. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. We thought it'd be great to learn from a German about what the European, but also specifically the German outlook on what's going on in Israel and Palestine is right now. What is the mood in Germany? What is Germany thinking about this?
Well, it's twofold. First of all, I think everyone, like any person with empathy and a bit of sort of humanity left within themselves, were just appalled and sickened by what we all saw on 7th of October. So the shock, that this is happening, that terror is being live streamed into everybody's smartphone, basically. I think we all share that. The sort of German uniqueness is of course, that our country will always be very closely linked to the State of Israel, which was founded shortly, or so basically, actually around the time the Republic of Germany was founded. And so a lot of Germans feel, and we've all sort of been taught our history in school, feel a responsibility for the never again. That said, there is a lot of never again at panels and receptions and official statements. And then when it comes to implementing never again, what we see at the moment is that we have large protests, not as large maybe as in London, but still we've had hundreds of people on the streets, sometimes clashing with the police, violent demonstrations, so-called peace in the Middle East or free Palestine demonstrations, but they all turned out to be anti-Semitic protests in the end. We saw a mob shouting Scheiß Juden. I don't think I need to translate that, in front of a synagogue in the region in Gelsenkirchen. We've had people hand out sweets to celebrate the atrocities committed by Hamas. And this is as well Palestinian or Arab migrants, second generation, third generation, first generation, we can't really tell. But it's also wide parts of the radical left or even moderate left that find it easier to be sort of pro-Palestine instead of standing close to Israel in that time.
So, Tani, one of the first big world leaders to go to Tel Aviv was the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. And it was clear that Benjamin Netanyahu was very grateful for his presence. How has Scholz's visit gone down in Germany?
Well, because sort of on his way back, they had a bomb threat or sort of an air raid alert that actually sort of then dominated the news, because it was a plane full of reporters and they all had to leave the plane in a rush and lie flat on the ground. And I think it was important for Scholz to have been there and to have been there that early. Personally, I would have liked to see him go together with Emmanuel Macron to show sort of a Frank, yes, Franco-German joint approach in those times. There was a German who's actually there before Olaf Scholz.
Ursula.
Exactly, Ursula von der Leyen. And I think she did a great job by being there so early. A lot of her European colleagues from the European Council, she's of course Commission President, but there's also President of the Council, Charles Michel, former Belgian Prime Minister, they don't particularly like each other, and sort of the amount of hostilities within Brussels, their offices are basically across the street, unheard of or unseen of before, and there have been hostilities early on. They're obviously not as brutal, but they are still quite significant, because one side, the council side, is accusing von der Leyen of basically overstepping her authority, whereas the commission side is saying she's doing exactly what should be done. But we can already see that sort of Team Europe, as it's officially calling itself, is showing very little team spirit at the moment.
It's interesting, and I gather that she's also been at odds, not for the first time, with Josep Borrell, the foreign policy,
yes,
chief. So there's, it looks to me as if it was absolutely the right call to go. However, as you say, there's quite a lot of internal division over it.
There is, and we do see sort of national reflexes coming into the game here, because Germany, you've mentioned Scholz, he again has stressed what Angela Merkel has stressed before him, and basically every single German chancellor, that the security and the right of Israel to exist is a German, we call it Deutsche Staatsraison, raison d'état. That's basically a matter of highest importance for any action of the German state. It's not sort of a foreign policy issue. It is a German state affair to secure the right of existence of Israel. So that will always be a guiding principle of any German statesman, I hope, but it does look like it at the moment. We have other states in Europe. We have Belgium, France, Ireland, Spain, Portugal, who traditionally have a more Palestinian leaning history and policy. So I think Michael Higgins, the president of the Republic of Ireland, said that the German, meaning Ursula von der Leyen, wasn't speaking for Ireland when she not just said that Israel had the right to self-defense. I think that's one thing all European states do agree on at the moment. But she did not stress and did not lecture Benjamin Netanyahu on his, basically the way how to go forward in that self-defense. I think she made clear when talking to him bilaterally, personally, sources say that the EU is expecting restraint within the right of self-defense, within the international law. But she didn't publicly lecture him, whereas Josep Borrell and Charles Michel, who do that sort of social media loudspeaking politics game, made it quite clear and were very vociferous about their thoughts of Israel expecting or sort of sealing off Gaza, calling people to go move, evacuate to the south of Gaza, questioning whether this is within international law. And there you actually do see the split. I've actually been quite impressed by von der Leyen's approach, because I think it shows that she sees the bigger picture. This is not about land. This is not about whether you like Orthodox Jewish settlers or whether you think that Abbas should have an election, maybe sometime within the next 10 years, and whether the Palestinians should get their act together and stop the corruption and actually help their own people. This is about geopolitics. This is about Iran. This is about Russia. This is about China. This is about sort of our interests, and not sort of are we more solidaric with one side or with the other side. And I think von der Leyen has very much understood this on the same time when the European Council had their virtual remote meeting. Viktor Orban, the Hungarian Prime Minister, was sort of connected to that meeting from China. And we saw pictures of him shaking hands with Vladimir Putin, whom he'd met in China, because he really does not give or care a lot, let's put it politely, about what Brussels is saying when there are Hungarian interests or his personal interests that say that he should keep dealing with Russia the way he's always dealt with Russia, which is a definitely more friendly way. So I think not sort of losing sight of the bigger picture, which is there and which is dominant, and where the EU doesn't really figure at the moment as a geopolitical player. I think it's very much on Ursula von der Leyen's agenda. But then as some other EU, especially council representatives, say, it's actually not within her competency, within her authority to do foreign policy. So we still have the problem, is there actually a EU foreign policy? And if there is, it's certainly not a united one.
Talking about the bigger picture, is there any concern in Germany about what now happens in terms of the agenda in Ukraine? Because Ukraine has dropped off the news agenda for sure. But also I start to wonder whether it's going to drop off government's agendas as well, as this becomes the dominant problem in geopolitics.
Well, we've already heard Ursula von der Leyen, other EU leaders, also German leaders, the foreign secretary, the chancellor, stress that Vladimir Putin and that Hamas and Iran is not going to, that this new conflict is not going to deflect from the effort. We have to sort of keep on doing or keeping up in Ukraine. The thing is, with elections coming up, with the European elections coming up, with elections in two German, especially Eastern states coming up next year, public opinion, let's say solidarity for Ukraine may have peaked within Germany. And this new conflict certainly is not helping the Ukrainian cause. On the other hand, again, it's not about sort of charity. Do we like Zelensky? Do we think we should help Ukrainians? Again, this is about sort of our way of life, our liberties being defended somewhere else, let it be in Israel, let it be in the Ukraine. And I think on state level, people have understood we do have a problem in Germany at the moment with sort of public opinion quite fearful of sort of a renewal of Islamist terrorism. Migration has already been, or the influx of refugees, which is actually on a larger scale than it was 2015, if you take Ukrainian refugees and other asylum seekers into the picture. So European migration policy, German migration policy, German the German asylum policy is just the elephant in the room, and it hasn't been solved for decades, and the pressure now is basically bigger than it was ever before. Just one example, the terrorist who killed those two Swedish football fans in Brussels. I just read that he had asylum applications since, I think, 2011 in four different European countries, in Sweden, in Norway, definitely Sweden, Belgium as well. So four countries, which were all denied. And still we're sort of 2023. The guy's been sort of in Europe seeking asylum, not being granted asylum, in the end killing two Swedish citizens in Brussels. This is a very gruesome example or metaphor, actually, for what European migration and asylum policy looks like at the moment.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, we've seen you mentioned the demonstrations, and they've been going on all over the world. But also in Illinois on Saturday, a six-year-old Muslim boy was stabbed to death. There's a sense, and we were just talking about this, Tanit, you know, that there's a sense that this really is a global moment. It's a moment of profound, complex interconnectedness. And I think that hasn't been sufficiently reflected in the UK media, where there's a sort of reduction to it, as if it's really just a sort of Super Bowl of Palestinians versus Israelis, where people sit on the side and comment on, you know, either team, as it were. Is there a greater sense in Germany, do you think, of how international this is?
I'm afraid not. But as you mentioned, that shocking crime in Illinois, I was, I must say, the propaganda and sort of the ignorance is simply there, and it won't go away. You see what's been happening with a hospital, and the explosion at that hospital, how easy it was. You mentioned UK media. We're very sort of self-proclaimed, but seriously, sort of quality media in Germany that immediately jumped on the news that Israel had a strike against the hospital and bombed a hospital in Gaza without waiting until sort of all the facts were checked.
As did the BBC.
Mm. Yeah, and with the BBC, I heard that there apparently is an issue calling Hamas terrorists, which I, from a German perspective, that is just surreal. I mean, we have journalists and also public broadcasters and other broadcasters who sort of shift between terrorists and fighters and militants and all of that, but to have an official policy of not taking, sort of not calling a terrorist is very weird from my perspective.
They've rowed back ever so slightly, the BBC, which is they're now often referring to Hamas in bulletins and magazine programmes as an organisation which is classified as terrorist by many governments, which is quite long-winded and slightly
catchy,
mealy-mouthed.
Very catchy, yeah.
Yeah, it's very catchy. It grabs you, doesn't it?
Well, listen, I want to say thank you
for
taking time out of your day to come and speak to us. That's been illuminating.
As always.
Thank you, Tanit. And you can read Tanit every single week in the brilliant New European.
It's a must read.
Brilliant German splaining, which is worth the cover price alone,
certainly
I can
is.
Promise you. We don't pay her enough. She knows that.
Thank you, Tanit.
Cheers.
Tanit, thank you
so much for having
Thanks for joining
Take
us.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks again to Tanit. And that's it for this this show this week. Thank you so much. Get your questions into us and any feedback. The email is 2mats, that's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S, at tnepublishing.co.uk. And our first question and answer episode comes on Sunday. Big news. So that's two episodes a week, you lucky people.
Two. And formats.
Don't forget, the formats. Don't forget our new special deal, which is a free signed copy of James O'Brien's brilliant new book, How They Broke Britain, when you subscribe to The New European from just £1 a week. And so you just go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S, to claim that amazing offer while stocks last. And there is a link in the show notes. Thank you, as ever, to the third Matt, our producer, Matt Hill at Rethink Audio. And until next week.
It's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.